Hello, fools. Is everybody enjoying oil's drop to negative $40 a barrel? That literally means for one futures contract on delivery, they will give you 1,000 barrels of oil and $40,000 at the same time. Here's 40,000 and 1,000 barrels. Happy fucking Thanksgiving. What are you going to do with that? All you're going to do is figure out a place to put it. You know, remember in Christmas Vacation? Where are you going to put a tree that big, Clark? Why don't you bend over and I'll show you. Where are you going to put 1,000 barrels of oil? Why don't you bend over and I'll show you. Let's get the damn show started, shall we, instead of me rambling on like a lunatic? First and foremost, everybody always asks me, Chris, where do you buy your bullion? You're always talking about gold and silver online. Now I buy my shit from JM Bullion. Why do I buy from JM Bullion? A, because they reached out to me a couple weeks ago and said we would like to become a patron. So I said, let me order some shit from your service, and if it doesn't suck, then we can do that. And lo and behold, I tried ordering from them for the first time last week. Several orders. They all shipped same day, and they were all here in like 2 or 3 days. They do a great job. The metals are of great quality. So I've made some new friends at JM Bullion. They've been in business since 2011. They've done over $3 billion in sales. They are a reputable, trustworthy bullion dealer. And they get their shit done quicker than Kitco, at least in my experience, because I got an order from Kitco that I made on April 6th that I'm still waiting for. I think it just shipped yesterday. So very much liking my new friends over at JM Bullion. And they like the QTR podcast so much, they're giving listeners $5 off orders of $300 or more, plus free shipping, priority mail. You can check that out by entering in QTR5 when you check out there. There'll be like a gift code space so you can use that. And their link is in my podcast description. So follow and shout out my new friends at JM Bullion. Tell them QTR sent you so that they keep supporting the podcast. Please, I'm trying to buy their affection and their love. This podcast also brought to you by my very dear friend, Pete Hegedus, over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is the only investing day trading service that I ever talk about. I don't talk about any other ones. Pete Hegedus started his service because he was tired of the nonsense and bullshit of other investor services, day trading communities, where they front run you, where they don't care about how well you do, where there's no real community, where there's no real relationships. So Pete and his group of individuals decided we're going to start our own. After being a part of all these shitty services, we're just going to do it our own way. And that's what they've done. The people that have gone over there from the Quote the Raven podcast have told me that they love it. I talk to Pete all the time. He's a trustworthy guy. He's an honest guy. What does he offer? He offers daily watch lists, so you're going to know exactly what they're trading every day. He offers a live stream, so you can actually check out what they're trading in real time. He offers investor education. They trade red markets, green markets, options, equities. They closed 8 swing trades last week, 8 winners, and only 1 red trade. That's what Pete tells me via text message a couple days ago. And you know what? I believe him. I didn't audit those results, though, so that is a disclaimer. But I just believe Pete. I don't think he would lie to me. Any guy that tweets a photo of himself to me in a Liverpool jersey drinking a glass of wine at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday, I don't think is going to bullshit me. So check out my friends over at The Trader's Path. This podcast also brought to you by my dear friends over at Sanglucci and the Sanglucci Steam Room. Pardon me while I learn the English language. It may be a while, folks. Believe me, I only woke up 7 hours ago and I've only had 6 cups of coffee, so I'm still waking up. Sanglucci and Wall Street Jesus offer one of the most unique pieces of software on the web and for the trading community. They were the founders of following options flow, following big money coming into the options market to try and determine where certain equities are going to go. Nobody was doing it before these guys. Now it's kind of like mainstream. You see a bunch of other services offer kind of half-assed versions of what they're doing. Sanglucci and Wall Street Jesus were the original to do this. And they were doing the Steam Room when I signed up for Twitter in 2013. So that should give you, that was 8 years ago I remember these guys doing the Steam Room. I've known them since then. They were one of my first Twitter followers. I think he probably had 15 or 20,000 followers when I signed up. But Lucci, I've gotten to know very well over the last decade. Another honest person that knows what he's talking about that I can easily recommend. The link to his Steam Room is in the podcast profile, as is the 3LT playbook, which is his 3 simple rules that made him into a 7-figure trader, and the Sanglucci Master Course, which is a bunch of finance stuff boiled down in normal person talk. And if you ever heard Sanglucci talk, he's pretty much your fucking everyday guy. he boils it down and makes it easy for you. So check out all those links in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by another fantastic, unique piece of software, and that is Rumorhound. What does Rumorhound do? There's nothing like Rumorhound out there. Rumorhound looks at M&A rumors as they occur on a daily basis, and if you're a day trader, you see them all the time. They pop up on Twitter, they pop up on CNBC every day, and it takes those rumors, puts them into a proprietary algorithm that they have that uses artificial intelligence and looks at a million different proprietary variables to try to determine whether or not the rumors may wind up coming true. So it looks at things like financial viability of these companies. It looks at the likelihood. It looks at the credibility of the source. It takes all those things, does a bunch of computerized shit with it, and spits you back out a very easy to read recommendation as to whether or not it's something you should be paying attention to or not. And we all know you can make money or lose money on M&A rumors if your spider senses are tingling and you think, hey, this is a deal that might go through or a deal that might not go through. If you can put a logical case together and bet accordingly and make the right bet, it's a great way to make some money. So Rumorhound, another service like Lucci, like Pete, and like JM Bullion too, that will eventually pay for itself if you do it right. They are offering a 14-day trial. So sign up using the link in the podcast description. 14 days for free, and you can do whatever you want. And any one of these guys, by the way, Lucci, Pete, JM Bullion, if you want to haggle with them and you want better deals because you're a QTR podcast listener, get in touch with them. Tell them you heard about them on the podcast. Tell them you only want to pay fucking X amount. Tell them you only have X amount. They'll do business with you. They're friends of mine. Honest to God, tell them I sent you, and they'll get a deal done for you. I promise you. I swear to you. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Jay Mintzmyer. We're going to have you on soon, Jay, I promise. My buddy Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause. We just raised over $130,000 for COVID-19. Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, Crichton Titus, Dylan Davis. My dear friend Ken is still in the house. And some of my newest patrons. Then I'll give you two rules for the podcast. Then we're going to get on our merry way today. First and foremost, I want to thank Roberto Walter, Chris Newell, John W., my homeboy Steve Taylor, Michael Zilberfarb. What's going on? Got it first try, motherfucker. Bet you didn't think I was gonna. Kip and Brian Vassallo, Garrett Baldwin. Thank you, brother. Michael Portno, Bart Courtwright, Mark Twitchell, and Bad Daddy Publishing. All my homies have been checking in on PayPal. Thank you guys so much. The rules for this podcast go as follows. Take two drinks to the face because we're about to go down the Hitler rabbit hole, whatever the hell that means. Number one, I can't wait to see what this dude's been up to since the last time I talked to him. Take two to the face. There is a mandatory two-drink minimum for this podcast. I don't want to be much of a disciplinarian, but if you don't do it, bad things will happen. That's all I'm going to say. And also, I'm not an investment advisor. Obviously, none of this is investment advice. None of this has been vetted. None of it's life advice. And I stand by nothing that I or my guests say. I disclaim everything that's ever been said on my podcast. With that being said, I think we can get started. So my next guest is a gentleman that I friended on Facebook, actually, after the last time that we spoke, and so have kind of been voyeuristically looking into his affairs as the last 6-8 months have played out since the last time he came on the podcast, and I happened to notice about a month ago that he was working on a new project, and I really enjoyed talking to him back in September of last year, where I had actually significantly less of a listenership than now. So I thought, man, it'd be a cool idea to bring Mr. Gerard Williams back onto the podcast and maybe talk a little bit about some of the work that he's done and what he's working on now. For a introduction, Mr. Williams is an international journalist and historian. He's had an esteemed career spanning over 30 years. His resume includes acting as duty editor for Reuters, the BBC, and Sky News. 10 years ago, while reporting in Argentina, Williams came across evidence in a local archive that changed the way he looked at historical reporting. Nazi war criminals, potentially including Adolf Hitler, used clandestine international routes to flee defeated Germany for safe haven in Argentina and other South American countries. Using these archives, eyewitness reports, and other local histories, Williams published the book, Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Despite the rigor in his journalism and his adherence to the facts and evidence, the international community has largely ignored him. And I saw Mr. Williams, I think, about a year ago on a Netflix documentary. And many people, many of my listeners wrote in and said that they saw him on Hunting Hitler, which was another television show, I believe, on the Discovery Channel. So, Mr. Williams, how you doing, brother?
Chris, great. Thank you very much. It's strange times we live in, but I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, actually. For all intents and purposes, everybody is safe, and my family is safe and happy, and we're bearing with it. I mean, how are you holding up in quarantine?
Yep, fine. Like you, my family and friends are all good at the moment. Let's hope it all stays that way. Thanks very much for having me back on the show, Chris. It's nice to be here again.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on. So what I was hoping we could do is kind of review what got you to working on this new project that you're working on, and then we could talk about that a little bit. But I fear that there's many people that have that are listening now that didn't listen to our past interview. So if you can, tell my listeners a little bit about the gist of the work that you've been doing over the last decade.
Sure. Well, it all started very, very strangely, actually, Chris. I've been an international TV newsman for coming up 40 years now, not 30, unfortunately. So I covered both Gulf Wars, Baghdad twice, the war in Bosnia, the massacres in Rwanda, famines in Africa back in the 80s. I'd always done very serious stories. And I was in Argentina with my own production company doing a bunch of material there. On the dirty war, where 30,000 of their own people were murdered by their fascist government, on the economy after Argentina collapsed, and just various stories, and loved Argentina and its people, and came across this incredibly strange story to me at the time, that Adolf Hitler had lived after the fall of Berlin and had escaped to Argentina on a submarine. And mainly, I just laughed, but I thought, I've never done a silly conspiracy theory story in my life. And I was getting a bit tired of hanging around car parks in occupied zones in flak jackets and 30-degree heat. And so I thought I'd do a silly story about a man with a moustache escaping to Argentina after World War II. And then I started to look into it. And to be honest with you, Chris, the smile was wiped off my face within about 3 weeks. There is no evidence that Adolf Hitler died in the bunker in Berlin. The Russians said they had his skull. That's since been DNA tested, and it's that of a woman in her 40s. So it couldn't have been Eva Braun's skull either, because she was considerably younger. There is no evidence at all that Hitler died in Berlin, but there are many, many reports of him escaping, including the testimony of the pilot who flew him out of Berlin as the Russians encircled the city. And report after report after.
Oh, did I lose you?
Specifically. Oh. No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Sorry. Report did after report after report of what?
Sorry, you still there?
I'm still here. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to do a pickup?
No, we're fine. The last thing that we heard was that you had reports from the pilots that had flown him there.
Report from the pilot who'd flown him out of Berlin. And then report after report after report of him being in Argentina, specifically at a place near San Carlos de Bariloche in Patagonia, at a house called Inalco, at the end of Lake Nahuelhapi. And I started to look at the evidence. You know, Marshal Zhukov, the commanding officer of Russian forces in Berlin, said that Hitler had escaped. Eisenhower in the 50s said they had no proof that he was dead. He hoped that he was dead, but he had no proof. And there are very serious people who have said at the time, and I go back to people like the reporter Thomas Cadet of the BBC, who was embedded with the Russians when they took the bunker, who said they had found no body that could have been Hitler's. They found bodies, and they were dressed in Hitler's uniforms, but they were not Adolf Hitler. And as I started to look at this and then get into it in much more detail. And in the book I wrote with my military historian friend Simon Dunstan, Grey Wolf, we do go into detail. There are 83 pages of notes in the back of that book. I do not make things up in my bedroom. And we walked the ground. It became obvious that Hitler had escaped, flown to Spain, from Spain to the Canary Islands, where he was met by a pack of U-boats, and those U-boats took him to Argentina. I've now spent the last 12 years looking at the extent of the Nazis' presence post-World War II, and I have to say that it's incredibly scary what they managed to achieve after World War II. The fact that Hitler escaped and lived until his death in 1962 is almost inconsequential as to what actually happened with the money they stole, the organizations they'd set up, and what they managed to achieve post-World War II. And that's what the new project's about, is to try and expose the extent of the Nazis' operations worldwide after the World War.
Interesting. So to go back, I remember the last time that we talked, one of the things that you brought up was you thought that, or there was some evidence that they had been using body doubles, in essence, in Berlin. Is that right?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Hitler had at least three body doubles that I know of. In fact, the last pictures of Adolf Hitler, when he's handing out medals to the Hitler Youth, which is supposedly April 1945, but are in fact March 1945, that's definitely a double. We've had his face mapped by a senior clinician, and it's definitely not Adolf Hitler. So we know that he was using doubles in March 1945, and there are many, many examples of him using doubles prior to that. I mean, it's been something that leaders have done all down the ages. I mean, Saddam Hussein had at least three or four doubles. I met one of them in Baghdad, which is another story. Winston Churchill had doubles. Stalin had doubles all over the place. So it's not an unusual thing for people to have lookalikes acting in their place.
What were the circumstances where you met Saddam Hussein's body double?
He was in the green zone when I was there doing a six-week producing stint. And I just met him as I walked into the lobby of the hotel. he spoke English, so we had a chat.
And how did you, I mean, did you just know by looking at him? Did you know, did he tell you, hi, I'm,
yeah,
you know, Fred
exactly
Hussein,
like,
Saddam's body?
Saddam Hussein.
What's that?
The guy looked exactly like Saddam and was surrounded by a bunch of reporters who wanted an interview with him anyway.
Yeah, but how did you know it wasn't him?
I think Saddam was dead by that stage. I can't remember, but it would have been very unlikely under American occupation for Saddam Hussein to be in the lobby at the Al Rashid Hotel in Baghdad.
Interesting. Very interesting. And so when people say that Hitler had body doubles, was this something that was known while he was alive still and, you know, while he was in power? Or was it? Did this kind of come to light after the fact?
By both American intelligence and British intelligence, that Hitler had been using a body double on numerous occasions.
And so it was, I'm sorry, because I lost you for a second. It was relatively well known then.
Yeah, relatively well known within the intelligence community, yes.
Got it. So we take this trip to Argentina. What kind of evidence did you come up with while you went in Argentina, and give my listeners kind of an idea of the amount of research that you did, because my listeners are all evidence-based, all fact-based. So that's what they
want.
I've
been to Argentina, I think, 18, 19 times. And I've walked the ground. I've spoken to people who whose parents worked with Hitler, who waited upon him. I've spoken to other people who directly met Hitler, and again, were little people who waited upon him. Reports from, areas as strange as Polish newspapers that describe the son of an SS man and the drive to the house at Hitler's Valley, which is what the area is still known as by a number of people, in Bariloche, or just down from Bariloche, near Villa Angostura. And it was just ridiculous. I mean, I was there making just after I'd written Grey Wolf with Simon, I was making a drama documentary, Grey Wolf, which is available on Amazon Prime for people to see. And my makeup artist, the only Oscar-nominated makeup artist in Argentina, a wonderful man called Oscar Moulet, had been off doing an advert, a TV ad for BMW in Paraguay. And at the dinner, which was hosted by the head of BMW in Paraguay, he asked Oscar what he'd been working on. Oscar said, I'd been working on a drama documentary about Hitler escaping to Argentina after World War II. And the head of BMW in Paraguay looked at Oscar and said, oh, yeah, my parents knew him very well after the war. And stories like that just kept on dropping. Then there are FBI reports. There are British intelligence reports. There are CIA reports, all which say that Adolf Hitler was in Argentina post-World War II, alongside Martin Bormann, who actually is the key to all this.
And who's that?
Martin Bormann. He's pretty much somebody who's been airbrushed out of history. I mean, the man was the leader of the party, Reichsleiter Martin Bormann. He's often described as Hitler's secretary, but he wasn't. He was the secretary of the Nazi party. But from 1943 onwards, Martin Bormann had built himself a position of power that if you wanted anything from Hitler, even if you wanted to see Hitler, you had to go through Bormann. Bormann was known as the Brown Eminence and was the man basically who ran the Nazi party and also controlled access to Hitler from 1943 on. He's a criminal genius, unfortunately.
So what's it like when you go to speak to somebody that says that they've waited on Hitler? I mean, what's a conversation like that like?
Well, sometimes it's very strange. Most of the time it's terribly straightforward. I interviewed one guy who contacted me in London. And in fact, the interview is at the front of the drama documentary. So it's real material from him. And he was very matter of fact. And I asked him at the time, as I asked all of the people I'd spoken to who had direct knowledge of Hitler in Argentina, I said, so why are you telling me now? And almost all of them said, because we don't want to die with this on our conscience. The truth needs to be told. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that's something as a journalist of over 40 years standing, I'm a great believer in truth. I don't do fake news, and I definitely don't do conspiracy theories. What we establish in Grey Wolf is that there was a conspiracy to allow Hitler, Martin Bormann, Gestapo Müller, head of the Gestapo SDSS in Berlin in 1945, all to escape the ruins of the Reich and go to Argentina.
You ever get people that say to you, because one of the things that I always get when I talk about conspiracy theories, which often, sometimes at least, can become conspiracy fact, one of the things that I always hear from people is, oh, how did they keep it quiet while it was happening? Oh, there had to be so many people involved. You know, what do you say to that? What do you say to people like, hey, if he was living there and so many people knew about it, and even if it was a Nazi neighborhood where many people had defected to, I mean, how did they keep it under wraps while it was happening?
Do you know, if you go back and look through the newspapers of the period and after 1945, there are reports all the time of Hitler and Martin Bormann especially being in South America. They kept it quiet, but also he was dead. So anything that actually said he wasn't dead, after Hugh Trevor Roper wrote his ridiculous book, The Death of Adolf Hitler, anybody who said that Adolf Hitler was still alive was just ridiculed and looked at in the most ridiculous way. Maybe now, 75 years later, or as it was 65 years later, when I was writing the original book, it's easier for us to go back and look at the historical sources.
Right.
I like to go back, Chris, to the reporters at the time, people from Associated Press, from Reuters, from The Times, from the BBC, UPI, or UP as it was then. To write stories that said Adolf Hitler was alive or that Martin Bormann was alive, as an agency reporter, it's very, very difficult to get that on the wire. I know I've been an agency reporter much of my life. So these people are telling what they see as the truth. And I'm stuck with it now, Chris. I have to tell the truth about this.
Well, you would think that over the course of time, hopefully it would be easier for people to look at the objective sources with less emotion, as I'm sure is what you're talking about then, right? Which was, it was just kind of frowned upon if you even wanted to broach the subject because it was so widely accepted that he was dead, right?
It's also, historians are innately lazy. And although you described me as a historian earlier, I'm not one. Historians like...
I think that was your bio. I think I got that from your website.
Historians like to write about whatever historians have written about.
Mm-hmm.
So once it was accepted
Lots of academics do that.
Yeah, academics like to do what they call peer-reviewed material. Unfortunately, the peers all seem to be terribly lazy and don't go back to original source material. I go back and have done, and it's one of the things I'm trained to do, is to go back to the original source material and question the findings. And, you know, as I've said to so many people over the last decade, if I'm wrong, prove it. And so far, not one person has been able to.
Yeah, have you seen have you seen those peer-reviewed journals where people will actually submit things and then in the middle of them, like, put the script to Star Wars and they'll bookend it with, you know, jargon and they wind up getting published. People, they don't even wind up reading it and they wind up publishing them in these you know, scholarly journals.
I haven't, but I can believe it's true, unfortunately, which is probably why I don't get published in scholarly journals.
Yeah, well, you're probably called, you know, a pseudo-historian, right? Is that what they call you?
I don't care what they call me, Chris. I know what I do, and you know, I call myself a journalist. You know, on a number of occasions, we've had witnesses who've been threatened with death for telling us what they told us, and what I have always thought, you have to take it seriously if people are actually going to threaten people with death if they will tell the truth to a working journalist, and that's what's happened to me on a number of occasions.
You've had death threats as well?
No, not to me. I think I've had death threats, but not about this.
Oh.
death threats in Yugoslavia.
Old girlfriends?
No, Yugoslavia and Rwanda and various other places people have threatened to kill me. It's the ones who don't threaten you need to worry about, Chris.
Right.
Because they're the serious ones.
Right.
So, I mean, I have been attacked, not physically, but I have been attacked all over the place for writing what I've written. And I was once described as 1,000% wrong by one, I'd call him a pseudo-historian, but an accepted person. He had a big piece in the Daily Mail in Britain about how we were wrong. 3 days after the Mail published it, he wrote to my publishers in New York and asked for a copy of the book.
Yeah, it's so interesting how that works, right?
Yeah, so he hadn't even read the darn thing.
Just to tie it into current events real quick, does it worry you when you describe the ethos of being a journalist back when this was happening and you say, well, it just wasn't widely accepted for anybody to talk about Hitler possibly being alive, and it just wasn't happening. It just wouldn't get published. It was looked down upon, whatever. Does it worry you when it comes to reporting on current events, and maybe specifically now like the coronavirus, and there's this big to-do about the World Health Organization? Does it worry you that that we give so much credibility to like an organization like the World Health Organization, where basically in the United States, all of the social media companies and all of the media companies have widely accepted that what they said was essentially going to be gospel for the length of this outbreak, and that there were to be no deviations from their official word. And regardless of whether or not you agree with the World Health Organization or not, do those kind of things worry you as a journalist?
I don't think you ever take anything completely at face value. Otherwise, you're not doing your job properly. But in a situation where you have people like the World Health Organization who have no axe to grind telling us that particular things are real, and in fact they've said on numerous occasions while I've been watching this story unfold that they still don't know what this virus is and what it can do, I think that needs to be reported. I'd end up getting rather political, Chris, and I don't want to. I mean, I find...
Fair enough.
I find that the whole concept of fake news, just because somebody says it's fake news means that it is fake news is something that's been immensely damaging to everybody's sources of information. Everybody's.
Sure, sure. I mean, I guess my question, though, is if this can happen in an instance where you're reporting on, you're essentially swimming upstream. History has told one story,
yeah,
and you are you're a lone person trying to tell a different story that you will swear up and down is correct because you've done the work and you truly believe it. I don't know. I just think going forward, isn't that something that you think about as current events, not even just the coronavirus, are reported?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, I'm sort of lost somewhere between 1945 and 1962, because what's happening to the world at the moment, it is what it is. It's the first time in my life, and the first time in my life as a journalist, that I can do nothing about it. It doesn't matter if I was working out there,
right,
at the moment, it wouldn't matter how I reported it or anything else. It will be what it will be. And that's very difficult. I mean, you know, I look at the United States and the way it's prepared for this, and I just weep. I mean, this is a country I'm very, very fond of. And, you know, today, 40,000 people dead. I'm not sure what could have been done to mitigate that. But something I think could have been done. And of course, when this becomes history, instead of the impact that it has on us every day, every hour,
right,
worrying friends and our family, when it becomes history and people go back and look at how things panned out, it'll be interesting to see what history's verdict is of what's been going on, not just in the United States, but all over the world.
Sure. Yep. And we see that a lot. You know, a lot of times conspiracy theorists will cite things like the Gulf of Tonkin incident in the U.S. and, you know, Operation Northwoods, all these things that have been declassified, you know, decades after the fact, where if you had brought them up at the time it was happening, you would have been put away. You would have been put away in an institution. So,
yeah, I mean, one of my problems in the area that I work in, Chris, is that so much material is still marked top secret.
Right.
That, you know, and that's in Germany, in the United Kingdom, and in the US. In Argentina, most of the files were destroyed in you know, helpful fires sometime in the 1950s and 60s. But there is material in the FBI, the CIA, MI5 and 6, and in Germany's BND that would prove what I've been saying is more than right and would expose conspiracy that I'm... I'm shocked by it, Chris. Every day when I read new source material or go and have a look at things, I just can't believe that we have been sold a history that that simply isn't true. I mean, for instance, the whole Cold War thing, the whole Soviets versus America thing, was effectively run by a Nazi intelligence organization in West Germany, the Gegenorg. And that was set up by the CIA under Alan Dulles. And America was completely conned into believing that the Soviets were capable of things they simply were not capable of. And as this information comes out now, even I'm finding it very confusing at the moment. Of course, the second book is called The Spider's Web. It would probably end up being called The Secret Reich. But we have a situation... It's the more I look into it, the more complex it becomes, that senior figures in the American intelligence establishment helped the Nazis develop post-World War II to a level in Argentina where they were probably a nuclear power. And then something happened in the 60s that changed any military ambitions that the Nazis had into simply financial ambitions. And they've managed to do that remarkably well. I'm not saying that Germany today is a fascist state. It obviously is not. But its whole growth, its whole being is based on the fact that the Nazis made it happen after they were defeated militarily in World War II. And the more information I read, the more information I get, the more I realize that there is... it's not like a new world order and it's not like the Illuminati, but it's like there are two Americas, the America of Eisenhower, who spoke about the military industrial complex and how dangerous it was, and the America of JFK, who spoke about smashing the CIA into 1,000 pieces and the America that ran Operation Condor and the war against communism in South America after World War II and employed tens of thousands of Nazis, gave the Galen organization hundreds of millions of dollars to operate. And all this is being overseen by Martin Bormann, the secretary of the Nazi Party in exile in Argentina. And I haven't yet put all the bits together because this is one very complex jigsaw puzzle I'm working on at the moment. But the breadth and extent, the involvement of major corporations like Siemens, Mannesmann, Mercedes-Benz, Hugo Boss, is to me very scary and paints a completely different picture of how America and the West reacted from 1945 until the mid-60s.
Yeah, well, those companies, I mean, they were all... Hugo Boss made the they made the uniforms for the Nazis, didn't they?
Yeah, it's as I always say, Chris. At the end of World War II, the Nazis took off their SS Hugo Boss-designed uniforms, put on their Hugo Boss suits, and went back to work.
Right, right, right. And there was this crazy shift where all of a sudden... In the United States, we had a bunch of German scientists, right, that were like...
Operation Paperclip. I mean, the Nazis went to the moon.
Talk about NASA. It. Tell me about that.
Well, America employed 10,000 German scientists, and how they got them is another question. But they employed 10,000 German scientists who built the rocket program based on Wernher von Braun's V-1 and V-2 military rockets that eventually took the United States to the moon. Now, my information leads me to believe that the Americans didn't just find Wernher von Braun and his teams. They were told where to find them by Martin Bormann as part of a deal which enabled Bormann, Hitler, and a huge amount of money to escape to Argentina and then eventually come back into Germany in the 50s to build the West German economic miracle. But in the meantime, America employed Nazis all over the world, not just in the rocket program, but in every scientific advance that the Nazis had developed. We wouldn't even have rock and roll if it hadn't been for the Nazis. Don't get me started. They developed multi-tracking, and that was something that America developed after the war, and that gave us rock and roll.
Interesting. So when you take me through the transition between the work that you did on Grey Wolf that went into the documentary, which, by the way, you said it's on Amazon, is it, if people want to watch it?
Yeah, it's on Amazon Prime.
Right. So you can check that out if you haven't seen it. Walk me through the transition between doing that work, kind of where that left you and where your new project picked up.
Right. Well, I suppose the big thing about Grey Wolf, the original book, was that Adolf Hitler escaped and lived in Argentina until 1962. Married Eva Braun, had two girls with her, and in the end was betrayed by Martin Bormann and died February the 3rd, 1962, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, attended by his personal physician. And that was sort of, in some ways, Hitler's escape and him living in Argentina has obscured what the real story was. I mean, it's bad enough that that horrible creature escaped and lived for another 17 years, but it's what else was achieved in that 17 years by the rump Nazi party and the rump Nazi organizations like Siemens, for instance, which was described by British intelligence as the overseas arm of the SS. What those people achieved alongside Alan Dulles, John J. McCloy, both of whom sat on the Warren Commission, but I don't really want to go there, but those who sat on the Warren Commission. What Henry Kissinger did afterwards, although Kissinger seems to have come to this story a little late, I'm still trying to clarify my information about Kissinger and why he became the person he became. So the next book looks at the structure, the infrastructure that had been put in place by Martin Bormann in 1943 internationally, so that there would be a party to carry on, and how that impacted on, well, majorly the Cold War, but also the redevelopment of Germany as a major industrial nation, and what it did to America and its politics.
Yeah, so what took place? I mean, you're saying there's 18 years where Hitler is living in Argentina after the world has assumed that he's died. That's fascinating when you think about it. 18 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Martin Bormann, who people don't know very much about and never comes up amongst the senior Nazis, like Goebbels, Goering, Himmler, although Bormann was one of the people who was tried in absentia at Nuremberg and found guilty of war crimes.
Okay.
Interesting, Hitler was never tried in absentia. Hitler was never charged with anything, even though they had no proof that they had his body. But we had a situation where Martin Bormann pulls all these various strands together, and he sees that once the Holocaust becomes a well-known thing, once people realize that 11 million human beings were industrially murdered by the Nazi regime, 6 million of them European Jews, but 5 million of them weren't. Once Bormann realizes this, he realizes that you can never march behind a swastika again. You can never march with your jackboots and your Hugo Boss uniforms. That's never going to work. So Hitler becomes sidelined in Argentina and is allowed to die, basically. Ava Braun leaves him, takes the kids, goes to live elsewhere in Argentina, away from the Führer. And Martin Bormann looks at how he can make the world work for him and his new Germany politically and financially. And that there's a huge sea change where suddenly all these old Nazis who are still trying to get back into power in Germany in the 50s, people like Hans Ulrich Rudel, Hitler's favorite fighter pilot, a close friend of Juan Perón in Argentina, and a dyed-in-the-wool Nazi. He fails in his bid to try and get back into power democratically in Germany. And I think Bormann realizes that the real way ahead is no longer to have the gloss, if you can call it that, of the Nazi Party there, and that they need to exert influence. And that brings me back to the fact that they probably did develop nuclear weapons in Argentina in the 50s. And that's a big bargaining chip on the international table. But it's politics.
Did they have the infrastructure there to develop that?
Yeah, the Nazis built it for them.
I mean, you're talking about how many people that escaped? 10,000?
No, we're probably talking about 100,000 European fascists who made their way to Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, Brazil, Egypt and Syria as well, and Turkey. But the majority of them going out to South America.
I mean, are there physical remnants of their presence? I mean, if you're talking about them starting developing a nuclear program there, I mean, it would have taken an enormous amount of physical infrastructure.
Yeah, I've walked to destroyed bunkers. I've been to hydroelectric plants with Tim Kennedy, who Captain America, my good friend from the Hunting Hitler series, where Tim and I looked at the damage done to hydroelectric material up in Tucumán province to hydroelectric structures. And Tim said, it's all military explosives. Somebody's blown the hell out of this. And after they had built it, if you look at the Humel project, so it's the island in the middle of Lake Nahuelhapi in Argentina near Bariloche, you'll see there the development of an Argentine nuclear facility under a Nazi scientist called Richter. Which didn't get very far. But there are Reuters reports, and I take Reuters reports pretty damn seriously, especially from the 50s, of there being two explosions sighted by Chilean pilots out in the border area between Chile and Argentina in the 1950s, mushroom clouds. And the material today, which I've been searching for ages, a senior Nazi in Argentina, a guy called Ludolfo von Albensleben, who was Himmler's adjutant and a war criminal in Poland in 1939, murdering up to 15,000 people in 3 days. Van Albensleben made it to Argentina, became a fisheries minister under Perón. And I found out today that he'd been applying for permits on land that he'd purchased to search for uranium in the 1950s. I also have been to the place where Eichmann was, up in Tucumán province, where they were drilling supposedly for a hydroelectric project, but sending core samples back to Buenos Aires to be checked. And at the time, when I was there with Hunting Hitler, I was pretty convinced that the only reason they could be looking for minerals up there was that they were looking for uranium. They were looking for a source of uranium. I'm pretty sure they found it.
When you were in these physical bunkers and you were amongst this infrastructure, I mean, was there anything there that you could point to that was tangible that could tie it to the Nazi party? I mean, forgive my rudimentary thinking, were there German instruction manuals? Were there Nazi insignia on things? I mean, how do you tie one to the other?
For instance, I'll give you an example. There's the remnants of a huge hotel medical center up on the inland sea in Cordoba, called Hotel Vienna, built by a director of Siemens from 1943 on. There are guard towers all over this place. And down the road from it is a house owned by the people who actually funded Hitler in the 1920s, the Eichhorns. In fact, the money for the Nazi Party in Germany came from a pair of German exiles in Argentina who ran a hotel called the Hotel Eden. But they financed Hitler's operations in Germany well before he was becoming anything of a shining light. Did I just use that phrase about Adolf Hitler? So there's Hotel Vienna, which is massive. Then there is all the remnants on Ila Huemel, where Richter, this German scientist, built a nuclear facility for Juan Perón, who didn't have the money at that stage to build a facility like that. And he had to get it from somewhere. And I'm pretty sure that that money can be traced to Martin Bormann and the money that was brought out of Germany from 1943 onwards. Then if you go up to, again, in Tucumán province, the hydroelectric dams that were built and were being designed by an SS-run company called Capri under a man called Carlos Fildner. Evidence of their infrastructure and evidence of their presence is all over Argentina, and in a scary way. And as I say, I've been there 19 times. There's also evidence of Nazi infrastructure in Chile. Colonia Dignidad is a fascinating place. And that has much more to do with Kissinger and Operation Condor in the 1970s, but it was built by Nazis in the 1940s. So, yeah, I mean, it's not footprints. Well, if they are footprints of the Nazis, they're giant seven-league boot.
I'm going to have to put you in touch with Whitney Webb. I know this wonderful independent journalist in Chile, and I'm sure you guys could chase some things down together, what with her geographic location, and she's just, I mean, this is the kind of story that she would probably love to look into.
Hey, you've got my email.
Yeah, definitely. Aside from just going back to what we were talking about earlier, about, you know, your trips to Argentina and, you know, aside from things like the newspapers, like you were talking about and these firsthand accounts, what other kind of evidence were you able to drum up in Argentina? What were some of the strongest things that you think that you would be able to, you know?
I'll give you an example. We were there in Bariloche filming for Hunting Hitler, and we were on the lake, which is one of the most beautiful places in the world. Very Bavarian, but it is one of the most beautiful places in the world. And I'd been there a number of times before, but I had to, for television reasons, pretend that I hadn't been there before and be quietly amazed at the Saracen Tower, which is this Nazi structure that overlooks the lake, which gives you a field of fire for about, I don't know, miles. Anyway, you can't go down the lake without passing the Saracen Tower. And on board the boat we were on was a lawyer, an Argentine lawyer, historian, friend of one of our production management team there. A lovely guy. He and I got on really well. He read Grey Wolf, so he knew that I knew the area. And he had a couple of things with him, and he handed me a book, and he said, "Do you know what that is?" And I said, "Yeah, it's Hans Ulrich Rudel's autobiography, printed in Buenos Aires in 1947, and then shipped back to Germany." Yeah, you know, it was by an outfit called Duro, who shipped loads of Nazi propaganda back to Germany post-war, including a foul magazine called Der Weg, The Way. Anyway, I said, yeah, and it looks like it's a first edition. I said, I've not seen one physically before. I've seen copies of Rudel's book. And he said, yeah, look at the front. In the front in German, it's written, to my dear comrade, with all best wishes, Hans-Ulrich Rudel. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Where'd you get that? He said, oh, well, one of my clients, who is a lady of limited intelligence, it came from her father's effects. And I said, oh, who was her father? He said he was a senior SS man who came here after the war, early after the war in 46. I said, right. And he also had in his hand a little cloth bag, you know, like you have a jewelry in. And he said, have a look at that. So I opened it up, and inside was an iron cross, first class. And it's an iron cross, first class, from World War I, not a Nazi iron cross. And I've seen hundreds of iron crosses in Argentina. They're in every junk shop you can ask for. Most of them are fake. Some of them aren't. Excuse me. But it's rare to see a First World War iron cross. And I said, okay, that's interesting. Where did you get it from? He said, I got it from the same lady. And she says, her father was given it by Adolf Hitler here after the war for services to his security while he was near Bariloche. Now, there are only two decorations Adolf Hitler ever wore on his coat. One was the first class Iron Cross that he got for bravery in World War I. And the other one was his gold party badge, which he gave to... or allegedly gave to Goebbels' wife, Magda, in the bunker in 45 before he allegedly committed suicide. I'm in Argentina, and in my hand is an Iron Cross, first class, with provenance that had been owned by an SS officer in that area in 1946. And his daughter says that he'd been given it by Adolf Hitler, and Hitler only ever wore the Iron Cross, first class. Things like that happen to you all the time when you're on the ground. And one of the things I do, you know, I'm not one of those people who, although at the moment under lockdown in the UK, I am surrounded by books and I am reading and reading and reading. But one of the things I do, because it's how I work, is I like to walk the ground. And I have walked the ground in Argentina, in Chile, in Brazil, in Fuerteventura on the Canary Islands, in Spain, in Italy, in the Vatican, in Berlin. And, you know, I've walked the ground. And everywhere you go, especially in South America, you will hear a story of somebody's parents who knew Nazis after World War II. So the idea that 3,000 or 4,000 went to Argentina and spread out is ridiculous. We're talking tens of thousands of people there.
You said before something interesting, which was that Hitler wasn't tried in absentia. Why was that?
I've never found a good answer for that. My feeling is, and it's only my humble opinion, however humble it is that as part of the deal to allow Martin Bormann, Gestapo, Müller, Hitler, and the money to get out of Germany at the end, the deal was Hitler would never, ever be charged with anything. And that was a deal which saw the whole of Wernher von Braun's rocket program come to America, hundreds of millions of dollars of Nazi gold, which was nicked basically by CIC and OSS and brought to America at the end of World War II. Discoveries in every level of science, from nuclear physics through to germ warfare, you name it. I mean, every possible angle of science that you can think of, there's some Nazi input into American development after World War II. And to be honest, Russian development as well, but no, they didn't get anywhere near the bright boys that the US got. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the deal, Hitler was never to be charged with anything. So we have the leader of the Third Reich, who at Nuremberg, despite the fact they do not have a body, they do not have a confirmed body at Nuremberg, they don't have Martin Bormann's body either, but they charge Martin Bormann with crimes against humanity. Hitler is never charged. How? How did that ever happen?
Yeah, that seems like too big of a question to not have an answer, right?
Yeah, and I think the answer, Chris, is there was a deal done. And you know, I think also that people like Alan Dulles, and you'll read a lot more about him in The Secret Reich that's being written hopefully quite soon. they thought that it was possible, until the horrors of the Holocaust came to the public's knowledge, that if they had a problem with the Soviets, that they could bring Hitler back as a leader of German resistance against communism. And that would be an acceptable thing to do. You have to remember that there were millions of men, trained soldiers, in Germany at the end of World War II when they surrendered. And I think for a short period, the idea was that they could use Hitler as a figurehead to get Germany and Austria and Axis powers to fight on the American side against the Soviet threat. That never happened, and once the Holocaust information had come to light, it could never happen.
What did... This is going to sound like another rudimentary, stupid question, but, you know...
They never do, Chris.
I'm not a historian, and certainly I'm not as familiar with the... But when you hear, like, on-the-ground reports from people in Argentina, I mean, what did Hitler look like in his old age? I mean, obviously he wasn't walking around looking like Adolf Hitler. I mean, what... Did people comment about his appearance and his mannerisms after the war?
Yeah, I mean, the guy who's I interviewed at the front of the drama doc said that his hair was thinning a little and he was gray at the temples and no moustache, but it was Hitler. I mean, he was convinced about it. Martin Bormann was there at the same time at a dinner that was being prepared for them in a Buenos Aires hotel, but hotel run by the Navy, the Argentine Navy, so completely secure. Other people describe him as a normal man. That was one of the waitresses. And, you know, that he wasn't short. He wasn't tall, but he was okay. He was a normal height. And there's no sign of any trembling. There's no sign of him being ill. He's slim and he's not frail. I mean, he's 57 when in 1940. Right. I'm 61 in March. God, I'm getting old. But, you know, in my 50s, I was perfectly happily wandering around Argentina, and I'm damn sure the Fuhrer was too, sadly.
Interesting. Wow. And, you know, it's just, as a journalist, right, I mean, obviously you're doing this in the latter part of your career, so you've interacted with, you know, hundreds of...
About this latter part of my career.
I'm sorry. You've done this after you've established yourself and you know, you've made a career for yourself. I mean, you're a professional is what I'm trying to convey here. You know, you take on this project at a point where you have, as you said in the introduction, you covered some very significant historical happenings, and you've dealt with, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. You've probably taken accounts from tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. And throughout the course of meeting these people, because what's going to happen is people are going to say, oh, it's a bunch of circumstantial evidence. You got a bunch of people walking around Argentina, whatever. But what you're saying is, you know, all of this puts together a picture to you that is beyond a reasonable doubt, to the point of airtight, you think?
You know, there's a subtitle to the title for Grey Wolf, which is Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, The Case Presented. That's what we do in that book, is we present the case. It's what I'll do in the Secret Reich as well. I will present the case. It is then up to people to read it and make their own decision. But I would have been happy to take Grey Wolf into a court of law and prove that Adolf Hitler did not die in 1945. And I'm damn sure that nobody could disprove it either. The FSB, which is, you know, the current KGB in Russia, said that my work was complete nonsense. The book's published in Russia. The book's published in about, I don't know, 20-odd countries, if not more. And the FSB said, the story is rubbish. We will let people get access to the material that we have. Well, that was 2010. Not a word.
And there's not one person you wouldn't debate and not one forum you wouldn't present your story. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Yeah, no problems. I'm not convinced easily. I'm a natural cynic. I'm a trained cynic. But I'm a trained cynic as well, Chris. You know, I mean, that's what you do as a journalist. I mean, it's who, why, what, where, and when. if you can't answer all those questions, you shouldn't be writing a story about it.
So if I get an email after this podcast from somebody that's a professor of some ology that says, why do you have kooks and nonsense people on your podcast and old Gerard Williams telling a tale? And I say, all right, well, if you got the goods and you can go toe-to-toe with them, you'll come back on the podcast and we'll have a structured and civil debate where people are respectful with each other?
Any day of the week, Chris, any day of the week.
Oh, I love it. All right, my last question is, when you talk about the Nazi influence in companies, you know, we mentioned Hugo Boss before, you know, these companies that were around during Nazi Germany that, you know, continued
to... Siemens, Mannesmann, Mercedes-Benz, Krupp. They're all still there.
How, I mean, it's 2020. I mean, how much of the Nazi Party influence do you think still exists? Without naming names and naming, you know, companies, how much of the Nazi Party influence do you think still exists today?
Well, it's very difficult because you can't get sight of the shareholding for most of these major companies, so you have no idea who owns them. They're not Nazis nowadays. I mean, you know, they're not anti-Semitic, militaristic swine criminals.
Right.
They became legitimate. It's like a crime family getting legitimate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
they moved out of numbers and prostitution and booze, and they moved into computers and infrastructure projects.
Right.
But it's all about the money. And, of course, there's none of the original Nazis there who owned the shareholdings. It's their kids and their grandkids. So my father was a World War II veteran, sadly passed now. But my dad was 18 in 1939, joined up, fought fascism for 6 years, wounded 3 times, and one of my heroes, one of the great generation. And so I'm 61 now. So, yeah, the Nazi hierarchy's kids are my age, maybe a little older. And of course, they have kids in their 30s now who are groomed to take over the shareholdings and the approach that their parents and grandparents had. And they do. And I think some people have found this or aspects of it and called it the New World Order. Some others have found aspects of it and called it the Illuminati. Some others have found aspects of it and called it the lizard people. I don't go with any of those, or the Templars or anything like that. What it is, it's a bunch of businessmen now who have interests in particular areas. And when they need something to happen, they get together and they make it happen. Bilderberg is not a conspiracy, it's real. And Bilderberg is probably one facet of the way in which the New World Order, if you want to use that phrase, came up after 1945.
Well, I do want to use the phrase. I want to know what you think, you know, what the macro view of the world in terms of power and influence and money looks like to you. I mean, who's and where, if anywhere, do the remnants of the party kind of seep into that? I mean, globally, in addition to that, I mean, who do you see pulling the strings of everything that goes on?
The inheritors of the Bormann organization. And that would also be people in America like the Ford Motor Company. I mean, Henry Ford was one of the worst anti-Semites, Jew-hating people in the world. I mean, Hitler actually gave Henry Ford, you know, the man behind the Model T, the highest civilian decoration that anybody outside Germany could ever have, Nazi decoration. You can go into the grandfathers of the Bush dynasty, and they were involved. Chase Manhattan Bank. The involvements are so deep and so varied at different times that you wonder if there is actually a grouping, you know, like a world government. But I don't think there is. I think there's people who come together when they have interests that fit all the same. And I think Iraq II, the second Iraq war, was an example of that.
Yeah.
But at the moment, Chris, I'm still stuck in 1962 trying to work out who sowed the seeds and where they were sown.
Right.
you know, things like Alan Dulles' sister, Ellen Dulles, was senior at State in the US. She ran the German desk. The American ambassador in the 1930s in Berlin, where Eleanor Dulles lived, described her as a confirmed Hitlerite. You will not find that in any biography of Eleanor Dulles. She resigned from State in 1962. She'd never been overseas apart from the Germany, and the first place she went to was Argentina. And I think she's the Dulles family's representative at Adolf Hitler's funeral.
Interesting. So when is this next project going to be done, and how can people get a hold of it?
Well, unfortunately, the coronavirus has... my publishers are in New York, Chris. And they're on lockdown. And so they may decide not to go ahead with it. I'm funding all this myself at the moment. That's not been easy. And it's still not easy to, you know, try and live, survive, eat. It does get like that occasion, and bring in information on dwindling resources. But I'm hoping that the book will be written by November. And then if it goes through a normal publication situation, it'll be spring next year when it comes out. I'm also talking to various people about a proper television series. Not that I'm saying Hunting Hitler wasn't, but in some ways it was telly.
Right.
And I want the next thing I'm involved with, because I had no control over the editorial in Hunting Hitler. Good production company, good team, no big problems with it. But I want control of the editorial this time. So much money was spent on things that were never going to come right. And it could have been spent in a better way, and we'd have had a better story. So this time I want the real truth out there.
Well, hopefully with streaming now, you have less constraints. You can do something more long form, something that you have more creative control over. I mean, Netflix can do whatever. They can make it an hour and a half long documentary. They can break it up into 5 1-hour parts, you know.
This is an 8-part series, Chris.
8-part series.
Yeah, so if there's anybody out there from Netflix, they can find me on Facebook, or they can find me on email. I'm not difficult to find.
Yeah, so what is the best way to get in touch with you if one of my listeners has a way to get in touch with you or needs to get in touch with you?
You can find me on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way. I do get involved with people who are interested in my work. There's an area on Facebook called the Spider's Web Campaign by Gerard Williams, and you can find me via that. Or you can just find me as Gerard Williams on Facebook. There aren't many of me. I think I'm Gerard Williams 5, but you'll soon find out that it's me, because there are pictures of Hunting Hitler, pictures of Grey Wolf, and various other things all over me.
Right. Awesome. All right. Well, listen, Gerard, thank you so much for being kind with your time and generous with your time to come on and update us as to what you're working on. And hopefully people take the year here until you're published, get themselves accustomed to the story, look at Grey Wolf, watch the documentary, read the book, get themselves educated so that when the second edition comes around, they're ready to roll. And then I'd love to talk to you again.
Chris, it's been a pleasure as usual. If any of your listeners want a free e-copy of Grey Wolf, if they hit me up on Facebook, I'm happy to supply it.
Oh, I guarantee you, you're going to get some people taking you up on that. And I'll actually do you one further and say I'll place your Facebook link in the podcast description. So if people are looking for you, they can click right through. And I'm sure you might get a few requests.
Good man. Good man. Chris, it's been a pleasure.
All right, Gerard. Thank you so much again. And please stay safe, okay?
And you, my friend.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
That was the one, the only, Gerard Williams. The book is Grey Wolf. Check it out. And the next book is going to be called The Spider's Web by Gerard Williams. I'm going to dump that link in the podcast description right now. But thank you so much for tuning in today. One more time, thank you to my patrons who make this podcast possible. And I am booked for Thursday, Tuesday, and next Thursday, and then the Tuesday after that. So I'm fucking stoked. In between that, maybe I'll come on and scream and shout about a couple of things, like oil going to negative $40 a barrel. Normal stuff, folks. Normal things happening. For now, I got shit to do, so I'm out of here. Peace!